The Writer's Toolkit is published by Nick Hearn Books. Order direct from the publisher and get 20% off this and other great titles. Visit nickhearnbooks.co.uk. This is the Writer's Toolkit podcast.
Welcome back. In this season, we're exploring accessible routes to the stage for playwrights seeking to find or restore a sense of agency over their work. In this episode, playwright Farah Najib shares how the shocking discovery of a woman's remains went undiscovered for almost 2 years, inspiring her to write the play Maggots. When the opportunity at the Lion and Unicorn came along, she moved quickly to stage the piece, and Farah shares how the play resonated with audiences and the challenges and rewards of bringing such a poignant story to the stage. I'm also joined by David Brady, the artistic director of the Lion and Unicorn Theatre in Kentish Town, who provides a wealth of insights into the evolving landscape of fringe theatre in London and shares invaluable advice for playwrights and theatre makers looking to get their work produced. As usual, in the name of transparency, my conversations with Farah and David were recorded separately and have been cut together for this episode.
The Writer's Toolkit Podcast with Paul Kalbergi.
All right, let's dive in. David Brady is a dynamic force in London's theatre scene, serving as the artistic director of the Lion and Unicorn Theatre. Hailing from Coventry, David is an Offie-nominated writer and director, known for his innovative and heartfelt productions. His extensive work with Proforsa Theatre Company includes critically acclaimed shows like Feel, Lately, and Flashbang, earning him numerous accolades and nominations. In 2021, he received a special commendation for services to pub theatre from London Pub Theatres magazine. And beyond his directorial skills, David is a passionate advocate for fringe theatre, frequently sharing his insights as a guest speaker and writer. His commitment to nurturing new talent and pushing theatrical boundaries has cemented his reputation as a visionary leader in the space. Farah Najib is an award-winning playwright based in London, an alumna of the Royal Court Writers Group and Soho Theatre Writers Lab, and a graduate of Writing for Performance at the Royal Central School of Speech and Drama. Her play Dirty Dogs, written during Soho Writers Lab, won the 2020 Tony Craze Award and was longlisted for the 2022 Bruntwood Prize for Playwriting. Farah also dedicates her time to facilitating workshops for young people and reviewing theatre for the Evening Standard and the Stage. Her latest play, Maggots, played at the Lion and Unicorn Theatre in January 2024, receiving critical acclaim and a London Pub Theatre's Standing Ovation nomination.
Coming up.
It was just this feeling of impatience and not wanting to wait around for someone to program my work. So it just was a bit of a, you know, fuck it mentality, for want of a better phrase.
We see a lot of early career fringe theatre makers, and I would kind of encourage them, if they've got a show ready to go and they've got people to help them, you might as well go for a 5-night run if you can afford to do it and find the mechanics to do it. Because then at least you've learned all of the bits that go around the discipline of putting a show on.
The Writer's Toolkit Podcast.
Hi, Farah.
Hi.
Right, David, shall we launch in?
Yeah, let's go for it.
So for anyone not familiar with the Lion and Unicorn Theatre, David, could you give us a bit of an introduction, where you are and a bit about the space itself?
Yeah, so the Lion and Unicorn Theatre is a 60-seat black box theatre in Kentish Town. We're a big part of the Camden community, which includes things like Camden Fringe and stuff, which I'm sure we'll talk about as the podcast goes on. So I'm the artistic director of Proforsa Theatre Company, and we are the managing company in residence at that theatre. And we've been running it since March of 2019. So last week was our fifth anniversary of running the space, and it's sits, as we said, above the Lion and Unicorn pub, and they're very, very good to us. It's a Young's pub in North London.
Brilliant. What about the seating capacity and the configuration of the space inside?
So one of the things that we did when we took over was we took a really good look at the kind of how the space was being used. And what we did is we opened the space up into a much more of a thrust configuration, okay, which I think makes the Lion and Unicorn a little bit unique amongst pub theatres, and that we've got a little bit of flexibility about how we use the space. I think artistically, having the space in that sort of thrust environment means that the sort of difference between the audience and the theatre makers is broken down. So you can make it, I don't like the word immersive as such, but there's definitely a better interaction between the work and the audience the work is performed in and around where people are sitting.
Definitely.
So we have it on three sides of the space, and that configuration has allowed us to kind of diversify the work that we make and kind of bring it a bit closer to the audiences in a way that's been quite interesting over the last few weeks.
So what about in terms of programming then? What sets The Lion and Unicorn apart from other pub theatres?
I think one of the things that we have been really interested in lately, and certainly for the programming as we've evolved over the last year or so, has been a move away from sort of issue-led theatre to more towards sort of storytelling.
Yeah.
What I mean by that is encouraging theatre makers to make and create fully recognised stories and do a lot more of an analysis in the worlds that they create for fringe theatre. So certainly after the pandemic, we were seeing a lot of, and for obvious reasons, shows that were like one chair, one person, one issue-led piece of theatre, often around activism or particular causes that were very important to the people that were making that work.
Yeah.
I think one of the things that's been really good for me as the artistic director lately has been to kind of encourage the theatre makers to make properly realised stories that tell that take the audience on a journey, really, and kind of focus on a world, focus on a, you know, a beginning and a middle and an end, as opposed to kind of, like I say, standing up and kind of lecturing the audience about something that's very specific to them. And we've seen a really kind of expanded use of that storytelling for those shows, which has been really, really good to see.
Yeah, that's really interesting, actually. I made a similar point at the end of my chat with Michelle and Zena on the Camden Fringe pod recently. And I was saying, you know, I think there's been this prevailing belief for a while that in order to be a worthy piece of theatre, it has to be a state of the nation play or an issue-based play. And I think there is real value in entertainment for entertainment's sake. You know, I think the only difference between worth and value is interest. And if enough people other than you and your mates find it interesting, then it is a valuable and worthy piece of theatre. So I think we do need to go back to and embrace that kind of story-first approach, really.
I think also thinking about the competition, I think in a world where perhaps there's a running argument at the minute about the cost of West End tickets in particular, and in some cases those West End shows are very expensive, but actually in other respects you've got tickets for like big musicals that are slashing their tickets to kind of bring in audiences. Certainly shows that have got a longer life. I joke to people that are coming in about, you know, you're competing with 15 quid tickets for Wicked on a Wednesday evening, for example. I think primarily fringe theatre is made for the artist's friends and family. And so I always try and sit down with the artist and kind of say, what's the crossover appeal of your story? Like, what's going to bring somebody in that's never heard of you or wants to know about you in to experience the story that you're creating? And I think sometimes some of those very heavy issue-led stories or stories that are quite niche in their approach can kind of alienate the general audience. And actually what we have a responsibility to do as theatre makers is get people to sit down and see the work. And, you know, if they get to go to the pub afterwards and have a pint, that's even better.
Yeah.
But I think it's about going, right, commercially speaking, fringe theatre has always been on the edges of what's commercial, but actually with a more commercial mindset, how can producers make shows that bring people in and encourage them to sit down on a Wednesday evening and like I say, spend that 15 quid with us rather than spending it in the West End, where of course there is a place for it. But I guess opening up that work to new audiences is super important too, outside of kind of an Edinburgh Fringe or a Camden Fringe environment, I think.
Definitely. So what sort of things then have you had on recently that have sat within that?
Yeah, I think so. The in-house company, so Proforce Theatre Company, are responsible for making what I would consider to be the sort of flagship or tent peg shows. And, and they set the tone for what we expect the other companies to come in like. That work is then kind of complemented or supported by a group of associate artists that have got a different kind of programming bias to the in-house company that take on different work. So, for example, Fight or Flight Productions, who are one of our big associate artist sort of colleagues, make work that's kind of a little bit darker in tone, still very story driven, but is a little bit more insular in its approach. We've just had a show on called Maggots, by written by Farah Najib, which was a set in a housing block, like a tower block in London, where there was a death in the community, and it's about how the neighbourhood and the connections in that building are formed. Next week, in the week's coming, we've got Insult to Injury, which is from another of our associate artists called Moonloaf, and it's a much more satirically led, politically driven sort of comedy drama about content moderators in social media settings who've just been bought out by their new boss. So it's all very topical. And I think those different types of shows mean that we can keep the programme varied and interesting. And hopefully the quality of that associate artist work, you know, runs throughout the year and is kind of a benchmark for what we would hope to bring in from other artists as the year goes on.
I think that's a great time to segue into my second guest today, Farah Najib, the writer of the play that David was talking about there, Maggots, and find out about its journey to The Lion and Unicorn. Farah, I was curious to read about your play, because when I first read about it, I wrongly assumed it was based on the story, similar story, about Joyce Carol Vincent, who is the subject of the Carol Morley documentary Dreams of a Life.
Yes.
I'm sure you know about that.
I watched that during my research process.
Okay, so it's not that story. Tell us about Maggots.
Yeah, Maggots is this kind of intimate storytelling show that zooms in on the lives of a group of neighbours who suspect that someone has died in their midst, and it's about how they deal with it and how the kind of trauma of that intercepts their daily lives.
Yeah, I would love to have seen it because I'm kind of really interested in this idea of the absent protagonist and how we can make a character, you know, make their presence felt on stage when they're absent from the scenes.
Yeah, the absent central character was something that I thought a lot and talked a lot about to people as well.
Yeah. So how did the piece come about then? What was the genesis of the idea?
So back in 2022, actually, I was on a writing residency at a theatre, and I'd been tasked with coming up for an idea for a new play, which was a bit, well, it was very daunting, actually, because I'd been like with the same play for multiple years at that point, and the theatre that I was working with knew that, and they were just like, just go and just go and think about something else for a bit. But I was going in without any ideas. And then I saw this news story about a woman who had unfortunately died in her flat and basically been left there for over 2 years, between like 2019 and 2021, so the pandemic kind of within that. And it just really grabbed my attention, this news story. A lot to do with the fact that this woman seemed incredibly anonymous. Like, even after they confirmed her death, nobody seemed to know anything substantial about who she was, which I found really interesting. It's like her work hadn't noticed she was missing. The people that she was living next door to hadn't noticed she was missing. So there was something about that that just really spoke to me because of what it said about London and the way we live just so separately from one another, so individually from our neighbours, the people we're literally sharing a space with but don't know anything about. So that was the kind of seed of it, really. And it just, yeah, I spent a month kind of thinking about that idea on and off, and then I left it for a whole year and didn't do anything else with it.
Right.
And then I returned to it in September 2023 when I went on an Arvon writing retreat, if you're familiar with Arvon.
So it's relatively recently.
Yeah. So I really, did nothing with it for a year. Went on the writing retreat, made the decision to have it on at Lion Unicorn. So it all moved very quickly after that.
Yeah. So how did you identify the Lion and Unicorn? When did that come into the picture?
Yeah. When I got back from this writing retreat, having spent a good intense week working on this idea, talking about it with Chris Thorpe, who was running the retreat, and Jasmine Lee Jones, two writers that I really love. My partner and his friend are associate artists at the Lion Unicorn. They run Fight or Flight Productions.
Okay.
And we'd all wanted to work together for a while. They had a slot to use in January. They were at a kind of a limbo stage where they were like, are we going to use it? We don't have a show, but we don't want to waste the slot. So I got back and I was like, oh, I've been working on this thing. Maybe we could do that, even though it's very, very soon.
That's great.
Yeah. So that, that was how it came about.
So did you leave the retreat with a working draft? Where were you at that stage?
No, I had hoped to leave with a draft, and I did not. But what I did leave with, which felt more important actually, was a new understanding of what I wanted to do with it formally.
Okay.
Very much bolstered by conversations that I had with Chris on the retreat, because I'd been exploring this kind of third person storytelling form. But I was holding myself back with it. I think I felt that I couldn't write that way because it was theatre and it wouldn't be interesting to people. And it was Chris who was like, you could just, he's very much just like, do whatever you want, write however you want.
Right.
So he'd given me permission to explore that form. So no, I didn't leave with a draft, but I left with some bits of writing that were in this completely new format that I'd been working with before. I thought it was just going to be quite a, you know, traditional play format.
Yeah.
And then I left realizing that it didn't have to be, and that I was much more interested in this other thing.
Okay, but it must have steamrolled pretty quickly. If you left there in September and you went up in January at the Lion and Unicorn,
yes,
you must have done a lot in a short space of time.
We did. And I really ummed and ahed about it for a couple of weeks, because I'm definitely someone that likes to say that I'm a very slow writer and I need X amount of time, years even, to work on a play, which definitely has its place. So I think I had it in my head of, I can't do that. It's way too short a time frame. How am I going to have it kind of in a good enough place to share on stage? But it was just this feeling of impatience and not wanting to wait around for someone to program my work. So it just was a bit of a, you know, fuck it mentality, for want of a better phrase. Let's just do it. The stakes are not that high, actually. Like, nothing bad is going to happen. So it was just a very short, intense writing period. We did one day of R&D, I think, like 2 days before Christmas.
Wow.
So it was intense.
Yeah, but it sounds like you had a lot of production support already in place from Fight or Flight. So in terms of bringing on designers, casting, technical stuff, it was kind of plug and play, I would imagine.
Yeah. So they are seasoned in putting on fringe shows. Yeah. They've done many, many fringe shows in their time. I have not. So yeah, they knew what they were doing.
So David, what sort of length of run are you seeing companies do these days?
So I think there's a real challenge in fringe theatre about the length of the run and pegging that length of run to the value of the production. And I'm going to try and explain what I mean by that, because I think traditionally we were all pushing for 3-week runs.
Yeah.
Flashbang, who is one of our in-house associate companies, has just finished a 3-week run. And it's actually the first time we've done it as the associate artists that run the theatre. I think with a 3-week run comes like discipline, financial discipline. It's hard to do. And spending 4 weeks of your life in a black box when you've got your life and your job and act as the same can be a bit of a tricky challenge. I think the validation that we've always looked for has been that kind of 3 weeks was the peg for like an, you know, Offie nominations or bringing in reviewers.
Yes,
and that kind of
that's
thing.
Right.
I think that's changing a little bit now. I think as bloggers have become more prevalent in the reviewing part of our world, I think that's changed how long runs can be for, or kind of shows going to different venues to kind of complete the same amount of shows. Also, the Offies have changed their criteria slightly so that they will now do 10 shows over a 2-week run, which I think has made some of that sort of access to the Offies a bit more accessible. So 2-week runs generally are quite good for, you know, it strikes a happy medium between getting reviewers in, getting people to see the show, building word of mouth for it, and then also allowing, I guess, creatively the opportunity to build and make that work. I lean into longer runs now just because creatively I know that I can continue to develop the work and it evolves.
Yeah.
I think sometimes we do a lot of 5-night runs, and those 5-night runs are brilliant platforms for people to come in and build their work for the first time. I think sometimes you get to Friday and you're like, well, if, you know, if for a certain reviewer didn't come in, or you're kind of just getting into your stride and then you have to finish. I think sometimes that extra week can be really beneficial to kind of developing a show and helping it create. So we're open to both. I think certainly for the early theatre makers in their careers, striking that balance between finances and length of run and creativity means that sometimes a week's run is more preferable for them. And we lean into that where we can too.
That's interesting. So it definitely did used to be that kind of, was it middle of the second week that you'd get reviewers in? So you needed that last week to then use the impact of those reviews to fill the house.
Yeah, actually what we're seeing now is we're seeing press nights move earlier. For example, we've talked about press nights being the first Wednesday, because actually I think, because in the same way that we've all got jobs and lives and other things to do, so have the reviewers. Often, you know, the vast majority of them do it as hobbyists, or they fit other bits of stuff around their reviewing patterns, which means that sometimes it can be sort of Saturday or Monday the following week before a review comes in. And if you've done a five-day run, that's too late for that review to be printed in time for the show. So I think striking that balance has been helpful, and pushing those press nights earlier has been something that we've seen happen a lot lately over the last sort of 2 years or so.
Okay. And in terms of the companies that you're staging there, do you find the majority are London-based or UK-based, or do you also receive international visiting companies?
I think it depends on the time of the year. I think traditionally throughout the... We program three types of work. So there's the associate artist work, which sits throughout the year, and they're hand-selected from within our sort of cohort of artists. Then we have the sort of general programming that tends to be a mixture of... It tends to be UK artists mostly, actually, just because of the time of year. We see a lot of international work coming through Camden Fringe, and I think as a gateway to new work, Camden Fringe is really interesting for international artists because it reduces the risk down even further. I think there's a lot of international artists use that opportunity to kind of do a lot of networking. Weirdly, we get a lot of work in from Ireland during Camden Fringe, and Camden obviously and us nearby has got there's a real Irish influence. So for the last, I don't know, for the last 2 or 3 years since Camden Fringe came back after the pandemic, we've really seen a kind of, you know, some kind of interdisciplinary artists from Europe come in and produce some work. We see a lot of graduate artists from Europe and from overseas bring work. Yeah. And I think we've seen quite a lot of South Asian artists now start to bring their work as well, which I think is quite interesting because they kind of bring work as they graduate and then they go home again. And to see that influence in the work being made has also been really interesting to see. And that's grown, I think, from what I've seen in the last sort of 2 years or so.
Definitely. And for international artists, I guess being part of something like The Fringe offers a significant advantage in that ability to leverage the festival's own marketing efforts, which is crucial if you don't have friends and family of your own in London to support support you. So tapping into the additional publicity that the Fringe generates itself can help, you know, fill seats and boost your audience.
Yeah. And also I think, I mean, Camden Fringe has got a lot to recommend it. It's one of those things is that it's quite collegiate in its nature. A lot of the theatre companies kind of network with each other for the purposes of Camden Fringe and perhaps a way they don't for the rest of the year. I wish sometimes I could take some of that collaboration for Camden Fringe and spread it out. Because right. I think when people bring a show, they bring a show on their like on their own with their own group of people. They make it for themselves and then they move on again. Yeah. I think what we've seen perhaps since the pandemic has been that interaction between theatre companies is not quite what it used to be. Okay. And people are kind of quite focused on their own sort of end goal product. Whereas Camden Fringe, for example, you know, that's all open season on that collaboration, which is really great.
Yeah, that's great. And I spoke to Michelle and Zina actually on the first episode of this season. So anyone who's just joining us on this episode, go back and have a listen to that.
And Michelle and Zina are such, you know, passionate advocates for, you know, certainly for the local area. And Camden Fringe is expanding all the time. It's becoming a bit of a juggernaut, really. And they're, between the two of them, they're a bit of an unstoppable force of nature. So yeah, happy to be part of that adventure once a year.
So what advice would you give to playwrights considering self-producing versus following traditional routes to the stage?
I think it's really different depending on the type of work that you have. I think it depends on the project to some extent. So our route into making theatre was that I wrote a show, and then I needed to put it on somewhere. And I was like, well, if I'm going to write it, then we're going to have to make it, because otherwise it's just going to sit on the shelf. I think what we see is a lot of early career Fringe theatre makers, and I would kind of encourage them, if they've got a show ready to go and they've got people to help them, you might as well go for a 5-night run if you can afford to do it and find the mechanics to do it. Because then at least you've learned all of the bits that go around the discipline of putting a show on. The marketplace for producers to take on shows just doesn't really seem to exist anymore in the way that it used to. And I think in a world where lots of producers are, you know, to some extent playing it safe because they have to commercially think about what they want to do, I think that dream of a Fringe theatre company coming in and getting swooped up by a producer tomorrow and then the next thing it making a transfer to the West End just isn't happening. So it's an incremental growth, I think. I think there's nothing better than learning about how to make a show than actually doing it. Yeah. And like I say, I started out and when I was writing, I was going to be a writer and that was going to be it. And then next thing is I'm a director and I'm learning about lighting. And I think actually the different elements of putting a show on that you would learn through the act of putting on a show, by that what I mean is, you know, all of the extra bits that come with it make you a better writer. They make you more of, and some people don't want to do it and that's absolutely fine, but they're sort of the process of more becoming a theatre maker means that I think the quality of the work that you make is better, stronger, more in depth, and you have a better understanding of what spaces are like. Yes. So for example, the more experience you can get making work in different shows, putting those shows on in different venues, the more you can write the work to suit the venues, the more likelihood it is then that your work gets programmed by those venues because you're making work that's more suitable for them, if that makes some sort of sense.
Yeah, absolutely.
We get a lot of submissions from writers that are like, you know, can you put my play on?
Right.
And when that happens probably 200 times a year, that's not necessarily the route into getting your work produced. I think it's a much more interesting thing about sitting down with a writer or a theatre maker and saying, how can I get my show made? And you say, okay, well, we'll open the doors. What would you do with a 5-night run? And that sort of self-driven production side of things, where you can make it work financially, I think is a really good way of getting it done. It's a little bit more actionable, I think, as well, than saying to a theatre, can you read my script? We don't have time. I know there are some theatres, you know, obviously theatres that have got new writing stuff, but there physically isn't the time to get all those shows reviewed and read and that kind of thing in the way that you would want to.
Yeah. So for anyone who thinks they could make use of 5 nights at the Lion and Unicorn, what's the best way to start that conversation with you?
So we have a submissions form on our website that we ask people to fill in. I think there's a real mark of people that kind of go and read that first, because it encourages you to kind of think about your show in terms of storyline, in terms of the personnel involved, in terms of the practicality of how and when you want it delivered. Mm. And then that submission form for me is a really good idea of the theatre company knowing, or the writer, or the, you know, the producer of the show knowing what they want to make.
Yeah,
I think if you can put a really good submission in, there are submission forms that stand out a mile because, quite frankly, they've got their shit together. I think that having that kind of awareness of what you want to make and how you want to do it, down to the marketing, like if you're going to approach a theatre, have a really clear website put together, have some sort of social social media put together. I think it's very easy to build it's very easy to start the process of building a show, but if you don't have any sort of audience to fall back on, you're already starting that work from scratch. So I think by the time you come to a theatre and you say that you want to produce a show, you want to have a really clear idea of what the show you want to make is and who's involved. Because like I say, in the ecosystem that we have at the minute, theatres just don't have the production space and time to help you to build that. So if somebody comes through with a really strong submission form and their social media is up to date and they've been interacting with people, sometimes you'll know that you'll get a submission will land on your desk. It'll be a matter of time because you see people appear on social media and they start talking to you. You know, 3 or 4 weeks later, the submission appears on their desk. Okay. I think then once you sit down with whoever the artistic director is and sit with them and say, look, this is what I want to make and this is how I want to make it. Realistically being able to make that work for your space, and before you sit down with that AD and say, look, this is my plan, go and see some work at the theatre.
Because sometimes
people just try and smash the same script in, and it may not necessarily be the right venue or the right programming policy or whatever. And I think having a bit of an understanding of the programming policy is likely to mean that you're more successful at being programmed than not.
Farah, how familiar were you with The Lion and Unicorn before you took Maggots there? Were you writing with the space in mind at all?
Well, that was the other thing that kind of pushed me to be like, yeah, let's do it, because I did know The Lion Unicorn space, having seen a lot of shows there, and the intimacy of it and the size of it actually really lined up very well with what I was trying to do with the play. Mm. So although I hadn't previously been writing with the space in mind, it actually felt like a really good matchup.
The conversation continues after these messages.
Hey guys, this is Paul. Just to let you know that my dark comedy, Almost the Birthday Party, is playing this October as part of Grimfest.
When a resting actor and his retired partner invite complete strangers to join a play reading group in their parlour, things take an unsettling turn. Roused in the dead of night to recall their fateful first stab at Act One of Pinter's The Birthday Party, hilarity and absurdity unfold. But as elusive pages of the script surface and figures from the troubling tableau demand an encore, Kenny and Vern's innocent quest for friendship spirals into a Pinteresque nightmare.
The show runs from the 17th to the 20th of October at the Old Red Lion Theatre, and you can find the link to tickets and more information in the show notes.
Almost the Birthday Party by Paul Kalbergi.
Welcome back to the Writer's Toolkit podcast.
Let's talk about marketing then. So what strategies did you find most effective in finding and building an audience?
That is a challenge with Fringe, which I think everyone knows is reaching the audiences you want to reach, getting audiences in. Although we had good audiences in the end. My day job is in arts marketing, so I had the benefit of having social media skills and knowing a bit more than maybe other people would know when putting on a Fringe show. So I think that was helpful, and I supported Fight or Flight with the marketing for that reason.
Oh, that's brilliant.
I think just trying to utilize the skills that you already possess to make the marketing feel honest, if that's the right word, or genuine. You know, I had the skills in my day job. Ross from Fight or Flight is also a photographer, so we use that to take nice photos of the cast. I think, just pulling your skill set and seeing what sticks to make some good output is important. And I don't think you need to do loads and loads and loads, because it's really time consuming.
Yeah.
I think less better content is ideal. Yeah, we had a decent response. We had a decent response. And especially once the show had gone up and we had a couple of good reviews, it then felt easier to get audiences in. And, you know, we filmed our own Vox Pops and just stuff like that, all that kind of makeshift marketing, which hopefully does help.
Absolutely. David, can you talk about the usefulness of digital marketing versus traditional methods? So 10 years ago, I feel like we were all buying 5,000 flyers and not necessarily knowing what to do with them. Is money better spent online these days?
Yeah, so marketing is really interesting, because we have this conversation on an ongoing basis about what the best types of marketing are. The best marketing is having a marketing plan. So really, from the beginning, sitting down and going, who am I trying to sell the show to? I try and say, look, boil your show down to like one tweet. Like, if you can explain your show in one tweet or One X post, or whatever we're supposed to call itself now, and that makes sense. I think strength of things like images is really important. I think a lot of people will kind of reach out to like stock images, but I think your stock images need to look cool and they need to look smart and slick. To your point about flyers, we've got a responsibility to be in the world as environmentally friendly as we can. And I think people aren't picking up flyers in quite the way they were for a number of reasons. Firstly, all of the flyer distribution people went bankrupt during COVID. So we used to have like a flyer box at the theatre where all the flyers used to go into.
Right.
All of those companies like don't seem to exist anymore. And I think there's nothing more heartbreaking than watching you give somebody a flyer and then take it to the nearest bin and put it in the bin. So I know people are kind of wedded to the idea of paper. I personally just hate the waste of it. Mm. I know that in some environments it makes sense to do it because there isn't quite the infrastructure or in terms of social media. But what we say to visiting companies is, you know, digital, paid social, actually nothing really beats sitting a human being behind stuff and doing stuff. And one of the best tips that I ever got about theatre marketing was business cards, because there is something psychological about if you give somebody a business card, it's a conversation starter. And there is a feeling of dropping a business card into a wallet and not necessarily putting that in the bin because there's a personal attachment to it. And I think now with, you know, one of the benefits of post-COVID life, I suppose, QR codes can be really helpful because you can put information in a shorter, smaller space. I think things like Canva and stuff now have made marketing much more accessible to people about marketing the show. So I think, you know, graphics are cheaper, they're easier to deploy. We live in a world now where marketing is much more throwaway and much more consumable. So actually, how can you quickly go in without spending a shed load of money on stuff, I think is important. I think what we always say is that quality of images, quality of content is also really key. You can do so much on an iPhone now. Like, you can take better quality photos in-house. You don't necessarily have to bring photographers in. But, for example, in-house, we've got a very good photographer called Ross Kernahan that works for us, who does really great photographs. I think you still can't beat, you know, production quality images to kind of sell and enhance the show. It just helps to lift it above everything else that goes on. And then the last bit about marketing really is understanding the difference between marketing and PR. Certainly for longer run shows, PR becomes kind of essential, really, to they build a relationship with reviewers and with publications and stuff that you can get in advance that you can't necessarily do as a theatre maker. What it does is it puts an air of credibility in. So I would say sometimes it's about, I guess, equalizing the spend between what you spend on marketing versus what you would necessarily spend on a PR person and have somebody to run interference between you and publications. And that means then that, you know, the show's got the best possible chance of succeeding and kind of managing bad reviews or challenging reviews or, you know, all of that sort of stuff as well. I think if you can do that and find the money for it, it makes sense.
Okay. Are you seeing an increase of PR people working specifically with fringe companies?
I think there's some specifically quite good PRs. Matthew Parker, who we work with, has got a really good understanding. He used to be the artistic director of The Hype. So I think he understands a really good, strong understanding of how our industry works and the infrastructure behind it. I think PR can be very expensive. So I think one of the things that's really important to do is sit down with your PR and go, what can you do for me? And, you know, don't spend £1,000 on a PR if you're not going to get £1,000 worth of stuff back. But also trying to understand that a PR is not marketing. It's a separate discipline. And what we find is that a PR's responsibility is to give credibility to the show in terms of managing their review content, bringing good quality reviewers in. And then it's your job as a theatre maker then to work very closely with the PR to go, right, I'm going to use this pull quote in the right place. So actually, for first-time fringe makers, you may not see necessarily the return on the investment of using a PR first time round or using marketing providers first time round, but you'll notice it the second time round because you're building. We, for example, in-house have just pulled together our tender pack for our show, and that's got a culmination of really good, strong images. It's got our pull quotes from our reviews. It's got all the stuff that we need. In terms of pitching that show to somebody else, we still have to go through that process too. So I think it's like you yield that benefit through like a longer term relationship with PR and marketing like services, I think.
Definitely.
And if I've got one pet peeve, which I'm dropping all my secrets now, but my one pet peeve is for those companies that just produce a social media account for one show. Like I must say, it's 5 or 6 times a week we get a single show social media account added to our page. There's no longevity in that. Like, and there's all the longevity in kind of companies that want to create and build. So I think shows change, but the theatre companies stay the same. So I always say to theatre makers that come in, like, how do you build your social media presence around you as a you as an entity, because, you know, this show is going to be successful and everything that you've aggregated from that show moves on to the next one. How can you build your following around the company rather than just this one very transient thing that's going to go away in 6 months' time? Yeah. Particularly in a world where social media is not a very nice place to be. Yeah. You want to make sure that what you have got there is for the long haul, wherever you possibly can, and make good use of it for positive things, if that's possible.
Yeah,
I just think it's about actually the identity of the company is really important. So even if you don't know right at the beginning, you'll know that by the second time you do it. Yeah. And it's about thinking that I would hope that most theatre people don't think about just making one show. They want to do it because they love what we do. So, you know, create your online presence, create a platform for you to build stuff and create your own ecosystem. Because what you want to do is you want people that have come and seen your show for the first time to be excited about the next one. And so that's why I always say, look, you know, get people hooked for the next time and build an audience.
Yeah.
That's really important, I think.
So, David, what do you think a successful run on The Fringe looks like?
I think that really depends on, it's going to sound like a cop-out answer, and I'm going to try to make it not a cop-out answer. It depends on the people that are making the show.
Yeah.
So we see all sorts of people. Our trajectory has been, as a company, as the managing company at the Line Unicorn, has been to get us to 3-week runs as soon as we can. And our next stage of our adventure is going to be transferring work from the Line Unicorn out to bigger venues. Some people come in and they want a really strong Edinburgh Fringe preview. So, you know, 2 or 3 nights, get a really good set of, you know, really good launch pad in London for the Edinburgh Fringe. And we've seen some really good examples of that happening, of where shows have kind of gone and done a really good job at the Edinburgh Fringe because they've been really careful about their London runs. I think the other thing as well is about giving people that first 5-night run to kind of work out who they are and work out what a show looks like. And so sometimes we find that a lot of people kind of come to us and cut their teeth on a Fringe run, and then that'll help them to work out what happens in the future. So we've seen, you know, companies like the Associate Artists have kind of come on that journey with us to grow and get bigger. Work with other people, learn how to do it. Some people come and don't come back. Other people come and you know, come back year after year. So yeah. I think it's about working out what your own personal agenda is and working with a venue that gets you if you want to make the work. Because I think it's that assumption of, like, everybody makes theatre because they want to be famous or would like to see their name in the West End. But actually the West End may not be the right outlet for them in the first place anyway. It's just a longer road to get there. And one of the things that I think has been a really interesting story is Spitlip that made Operation Mincemeat, which you've got the joy of looking forward to and seeing when you come back, started in a Fringe venue. You know, then it went to New Diorama and now it's gone to the West End. But that journey has taken 5 years. So I think what starts with a very small 1 or 2 night run for something then becomes, you know, a runaway success and you know, we think about later. We're due to host the Cambridge University Musical Theatre Society, who has an acronym that looks very rude if you look at it from a distance and look at it the wrong way. But that's where Six the Musical started. It didn't start with us at the Line Unicorn. It went to the Edinburgh Fringe. I think they could never have predicted the wild success that Six has now, you know, global success. I mean, they must be making an absolute shed load of money. But that started, you know, at the Edinburgh Fringe. You know, and those journeys are something to behold, really. Baby Reindeer, for example, that went to the Bush, I think.
Yeah.
So you never know what your trajectory is going to be. So I think try everything, but try what's right for you, I think, is really important.
So Farah, looking back on this first outing for Maggots, what would you say are some of the biggest takeaways for you as a writer?
It was a lesson in relinquishing control, as I think it always is for a writer, obviously, to hand over a script. But because I'd written it so quickly, I kept hearing it out loud. And I was like, oh, I need to change that. I need to change that. I need to change that. But obviously, there came a time where I was like, okay, I need to just give it in the state that it's in and be okay with that and know that I can do more with it after this run is done. I ended up watching the play most nights just because I had people in that I knew every night, so I wanted to go and talk to them, you know, socialize. I think in future I probably wouldn't do that because it became quite like, you know, to watch the play every single night for 2 weeks.
Yeah. And you end up watching the audience as well, right? More than the play sometimes.
Yeah. Yeah, which is a bit it just feels a bit tense at times, so I'd probably advise against doing that.
Yeah.
Another big takeaway is that we had a really lovely response to it. And it seemed to really make people feel things about community and the way they live. And, you know, we had people leaving going, oh, I'm going to go check on my neighbour now, or I'm going to go text a friend that I've not spoken to in a while, you know, which was just really nice to have that response, which is really what we're hoping for. We had a woman that I think she'd been working in social care during the pandemic, and she it obviously really touched a nerve for her emotionally. So that was quite touching as well.
That's lovely.
It was great considering the considering the time frame that we did it in. It was lovely to have that response. We got a couple of really nice reviews. Again, getting in as many reviewers as we would have liked was a challenge, but at least we got some. We did record the show as well, just for kind of posterity's sake. So yeah, we've definitely got things that we can use going forward.
Brilliant. So do you have any idea what might be next?
We got a slot at this pitching event recently where we basically pitched the show to a panel of industry people.
Okay.
And that was a very useful exercise in kind of honing in on what we actually want the show to do and what we would like to achieve with it if we were to do more with it.
Yeah.
Working with communities, taking it to community spaces, workshops, you know, companion workshops, things like that. I think it could come as a bigger package potentially because of the themes that are within it. So watch this space, hopefully.
Definitely. That's exciting. Yeah, it does feel like a teachable piece that you can kind of use to, as you say, to talk about loneliness and, you know, care in the community, that kind of thing. Hopefully there's some organizations already in place that might be able to help with that.
Yeah, there's a lot of charities that are doing that kind of work. The statistics on loneliness in London and the kind of decline of community are really quite shocking, actually. And that's obviously even starker since the pandemic has happened. So yeah, it's a big thing.
Sounds like you had a fantastic run recently with Flashbang, David. Can you talk a little about what's next for that production?
Yeah, so Flashbang's a funny one. We wrote Flashbang in 4 days at the end of the pandemic.
Wow.
And it's written about my hometown of Coventry, where I'm from. And it's written unashamedly about small towns, and it's about five lads from a small town kind of growing up, really, and going through a rite of passage. We did the show earlier in 2022, was kind of our first, you know, because we had the pandemic, we didn't get a chance to get it up and running. So it had a kind of earlier run, very critically, very successful. I wanted to go back and revisit the show because I think there was an opportunity for us to kind of give it a 3-week run, give it a proper life again, and kind of correct some missed opportunities really from the first run. We just had a lovely time. The new cast that we've got are phenomenal. They're incredible. The show's been published as well.
Wow, that's fantastic. And I saw that you brought it back in May as well for a couple of nights and then on to Loughborough and Birmingham.
Yeah, which has been brilliant. And really, that's kind of our sort of test to see how the show does outside of the Line of Unicorn. There's some really opportunities for the show. We're talking about what they are now. I think it's always good once you've had a run of a show to kind of regroup and work out what you want. It's been a genuine joy to work on that show. Like I say, very strong cast who are lovely to work with, and all four of them. We had an alternate this time as well, so five of them have been an absolute joy. And I think the audiences have responded really well to it, which has been really good. Pro Forces shtick has been normal people in extraordinary circumstances, and the work that we've made has really lent into that, like putting nice people into weird situations and see what happens to them. And I think having a group of actors that understand that and can personify that has been something that's been really part of our journey. And, you know, it's a real actors-led piece of theatre, I think.
Yeah.
And actually, I guess where we were with Flashbang this time around, we were very lucky. Benjamin Booth Bennett, who is one of our cast, when we were making the show, it was around the time when everybody's making TikTok videos. So, you know, everybody's dancing to that weekend song, Blinding Lights or whatever it was. Ben was part of a group of individuals. And when I was making the show, I kind of showed the TikTok account to our movement director, Lucy and Jess, who was one of our associate directors, and said, I want the show to feel like this. I want it to feel like this energy. And it was Ben and his mates who just left drama school, kind of, they had nothing else to do. So they were doing these TikTok videos in the street. Nothing happened. We did the show. The show gets run with an original cast. When we brought the cast back this time, we had 1,400 applicants for the show, and one of the last one to take the show was Ben Booth Bennett, who'd been, you know, 4 years earlier, I'd sort of slid my phone across the table and gone, I want my show to feel like him. So there was a really nice poetry in bringing somebody back in like that who didn't know that they were an influence on the show or what happened, and so that was really good. And then our other alternate, so it's called Ben Borthwick, is from Coventry. And so actually all of those things pulling them together, a show about Coventry now with a Coventry actor in it, with a Coventry writer and director, has made that whole show felt like it's come full circle, which has been really nice for me.
I think the term emerging artist often seems quite ambiguous, especially regarding, you know, who qualifies and when one can consider themselves to have emerged. How do you see this label, and what are your thoughts, I guess, on the impact of it on artists at different ages and stages in their careers?
I guess the challenge with it, the label of emerging is, you know, there lots of these competitions are all, you know, 21 to 35 or whatever, and I wouldn't have been eligible for any of those things. I think the work that you make as a slightly older person is different to the work that you make if you're 21 or, you know, 21 or 22, quite frankly. And so I think it's really important that the voices of those people are still heard in a really sort of healthy cross-section of what we do. And from the Line of Unicorns perspective, when we started, we had the tagline of be who you want to be. Because lots of theatres we were seeing were kind of programming to a specific programming mandate, whether it was, you know, a very sort of strict LGBTQIA plus mandate or, you know, queer-led work or whatever. We wanted to make sure that we got a broad cross-section of different voices. So the good thing is that I'll take any story that comes through the door. It has to just be a good story. And we've been quite lucky to program a variety of stuff. I think there is still work to be done by theatres and pub theatres in general, because we're often the path of least resistance in terms of getting work made, where we will sit down with people and have a conversation with anybody about wanting to get their work made. I think certainly the gatekeeping that exists in other parts of the industry around things like, you know, getting hold of somebody on the phone for programming or having those conversations. And again, it's all time and resources. I think that's the reason it's not intention is still there. So we have work to do to continue to make sure that we're as accessible as we possibly can, that we can facilitate wherever we can, bringing different people in, whatever the stage of their journey is. But I think, you know, it goes back to that real thing about quality of work and quality of idea and willingness to get involved. And I think if you get that, that's like 60, 70% of the job, it then becomes easy to say yes to somebody from a programming perspective. London's different to the rest of the UK to some extent, because I think the access to spaces and just the sheer options are bigger. Like if you live in a small town in the Midlands, like where I'm from, there aren't that many opportunities to make work, and then there's not necessarily the audience for it. Whereas London's got, you know, what is there? There's 100 off West End venues now. There's going to be a home for you somewhere. And it's just about trying to find the right one for that access. So, and I just kind of say, just get on with it. Like if you're going to write something, write it, but don't leave it on the bookshelf. Like be brave. Like if you can be brave, try and find somebody to do it. Our last, when we did Flashbang, we had 1,400 acting applicants for one role.
Wow.
So there's actors out there, right? You should pay them wherever you can. And, you know, that's a whole separate conversation for another time. But I think there's always going to be somebody that wants to read your work. There's always going to be people that want to engage with the work, and they'll always try and be a venue for you to kind of put that work on. So I agree with you. This idea of emerging is a strange one.
It's kind of arbitrary, right? It's the work.
Yeah, and again, the best shows that get the best plays that get written could be written by somebody that hasn't picked up a pen, you know, for the first 50 years of their life, and they just, you know, their family circumstances change, or they've got a really great set of life experiences that they want to turn into a story. I think theatre, though, can feel like a thing for younger people. And I think because of the enthusiasm and because of the, I guess, battery power that those people have, right? They're sort of like, they've not had life's experiences knocked out of them a little bit. Yeah. I think there is that willingness to work in environments that perhaps people with more responsibility find challenging, people that have other, you know, jobs and careers and all of that sort of stuff, you know, that they've got different paths which can preclude, like, you know, things, you know, it's weird things like caring responsibilities and stuff. Like your responsibilities can sometimes preclude you from being involved in that stuff. But I think one of the brilliant things about Fringe is that there's always, you know, even if it's for a 10-minute scratch night, there's ways to kind of poke that creative urge, and I think that shouldn't stop at any age.
That's brilliant, David. That's really inspiring.
I think sometimes people assume that you have to be all in to be able to be creative, and you can be creative in anything. You can knit, or you can build Lego, or you can do whatever. You know, there's nothing to say that, like, if you have, I still have nearly a full-time job, right? I work 4 days a week at a corporate job, in addition to my responsibility as a writer and a director and running the Line of Unicorn.
I don't know how you do that.
Well, you just don't sleep. and that's also not necessarily sustainable. But I was saying to somebody the other day about, like, this idea of like being a writer or creative, being all that you are, is not, I don't necessarily think it's very helpful. It's still equally valid if you need to go to Tesco and work in Tesco 5 days a week and write on the weekends. You're still a writer, and actually, it doesn't matter what you do as a career. Everybody's got to have a survival job, right? In a world where we're not all making a bazillion pounds all the time.
I've spoken a lot on this series of the podcast about pub theatres as accessible stages for new writing. Having seen your work now in front of audiences at The Lion and Unicorn, what are your thoughts on the importance of these spaces?
I understand why perhaps there's a certain perception of the kind of work that goes on at pub theatres, or that it's all being a bit, thrown together, or whatever people's perception is of it. But I don't know, it's just one of the only spaces, I think, where you can just try something, again, as I've said, in quite a low stakes way, where you can kind of cut your teeth and just see the response in quite an immediate way, which I think is just so important. And that was part of my motivation, because I hadn't seen a full-length piece of my own work on before. I'd had shorts on and things like that. But I was like, actually, this is just a very good opportunity to see how it makes me feel as a writer, see what the response is, and actually just talk to people and read real time and see what they got from it. So I think that's the importance of it.
Absolutely. We've got to have places to cut our teeth.
Yeah.
There's also just something magical about these spaces, isn't there?
I think part of the magic of it is that a lot of the time, the people that are in the pub downstairs maybe are not even aware that there's this other thing going on just up the stairs, that there's plays and art and people just working together to make something happen going on upstairs. I think that's part of the magic of it. It's like we just open this little secret feeling door and we go up and there's a completely different thing going on. And it's just incredibly cozy and intimate feeling, and I think just a very different experience from any other kind of theatre trip that you would take, that feeling of being very close to the people around you and all of that, which again was very fitting for the play and something we wanted to explore, that kind of sense of community with the people you're sitting next to. It's quite special.
I think so. I agree completely. I think I love the idea that you can just grab a drink downstairs at the bar, take it in with you. And very often, because there's such a low entry price point, people are more willing to take a chance on something new and to watch something they may not otherwise watch just because it happens to be on upstairs, which is lovely.
Exactly.
You know, we get a couple of people that come to the Lion Unicorn, for example, that weren't intending to go to the theater, and then they're like, what's that? And then you get into a conversation with them, like, okay, I'll try it. I think fringe theater is a challenge because it demands from the audience a bit of forgiveness and a bit of a willingness to have maybe the spotlight thrown on them in a way that you wouldn't get if you went to see Wicked in the West End, right? If you go and see Wicked, you know you're not going to be confronted necessarily by a story that's like not very polished, or, you know, there's audience interaction that you weren't expecting, or it's a little bit more anarchic around the edges, right? The brilliant thing is if you can get people that realise that they've got a really brilliant theatre space above the place they've been drinking for 5 years, and they're comfortable to go into that environment because they know that it's going to be for them, that's really, really good. I think because fringe theatre sometimes feels like it's not necessarily a sort of sanitized sit down and be quiet and shut up experience, and because the stories are perhaps not necessarily as commercial as you would expect, getting people that come to a pub to take a risk on it is trickier sometimes, but the reward is bigger. And the best experiences about running a pub theatre are, you know, when people come in and say, oh, I didn't know you existed, but now we'll come back. And when they come back and bring a friend, you know you made it, and that really makes sense to me.
Yeah. David, that's fantastic. Thank you so much for being so generous with your time and thoughts. There's so much to take away there. Really appreciate it.
No worries, thanks for having me.
Farah, thank you so much for joining us and sharing your journey to the stage with Maggots.
It's been a pleasure. Thanks so much for having me.
All right, thanks a lot.
Bye.
Take care.
You too. Bye.
The Writer's Toolkit Podcast.
That brings us to the end of another episode. A huge thank you to David and Farah for joining us and sharing their experiences and insights. If you're in London, be sure to check out the Lion and Unicorn Theatre and keep an eye out for Farah's future projects. You can find links to both David and Farah's work in the show notes.
Next time.
If you enjoyed my conversation with Madeline George and Winter Miller a few episodes back from the New York Theatre Collective 13P, then join me next time when my guest will be Ned Manning, a member of the Australian collective 7On. Seven playwrights united in their belief in the transformative power of theatre and the celebration of each other's work.
It was a kind of meeting of minds. We would, you know, get each other to dramaturg our work, and we trust each other so much that that's not a problem. Like, someone goes, okay, I think you're repeating yourself, Ned. I think you made that point on page 7 and you're still going on page 25. And that was because we have huge respect for each other.
Thanks for listening. And if you're new here, please don't forget to subscribe on your favorite podcast platform and leave a review or some stars if you're listening on Spotify. This really helps other writers to find the episodes and benefit from the conversations. Until next time, stay inspired.
Thanks for tuning in to this episode of the Writer's Toolkit Podcast. Be sure to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. If you enjoyed this episode, we'd love for you to leave a review.
and share the link with your friends. This podcast is fueled by coffee. If you'd like to support the show, you'll find the Buy Me a Coffee link in the show notes.